Hello everyone, my name is Chloe and welcome to a new season of The Burning Case, a place for critical conversations about our future on this planet and how policy making, but also radical democracy, are essential to make sure that future is not only green, but also fair and inclusive. We'll be chatting about the burning issues of our time, how policies are made, and give you the tools to overhaul the system. Let's get started. 1,134 dead and thousands injured. These are the outcomes of the Rana Plaza collapse that took place on the 24th of April 2013, exactly 10 years ago. The Rana Plaza was an eight-story commercial building located in Dhaka, Bangladesh, which housed several shops, a bank, and garment factories. On the 23rd of April 2013, large structural cracks were discovered in the Rana Plaza building. The shops and the banks on the lower floors immediately closed, but warnings to avoid using the building after the cracks appeared were ignored by the garment factory owners on the upper floors. Garment workers were ordered to return to work the following day. Due to management pressure, on Wednesday 24th of April, thousands of workers went to work again at the garment factories located in the cracked building. Only hours later, the entire building collapsed. Including rescue workers, 1,134 workers were killed. Nearly 2,600 workers were injured, many of them for the rest of their life. Many of the survivors had been trapped under tons of rubble and machinery for hours or even days before they could be rescued, sometimes only by amputating limbs. The Rana Plaza collapse was the worst ever industrial incident to hit the garment industry, as the tragedy has devastated the lives of thousands of workers and of the families of the deceased and injured. It also put the spotlight on the working conditions many garment workers face, from unsafe working environment to insufficient pay and precarious financial situation, long working hours, little to no bargaining power, and in some cases, harassment and assault. Since then, many campaigns have kept raising awareness about the impacts of the fashion industry, both on people and the planet, and called for structural policy changes to improve these impacts. Meanwhile, many consumers have changed their habits and embraced low fashion. Maybe you have. But has the industry really changed that much in the last decade? What are the sustainability and social commitments brand communicate on left and right really worth? Where are we transparency-wise, and what policies are needed? This is what we'll discuss in today's episode. But first, here's Melissa with some hot news.
Thank you, Chloe, and hi, everyone. Today, I want to talk about shareholder activists, which is a person or a group who attempts to use their rights as a shareholder of a publicly traded corporation to bring about change within or for the corporation. And more specifically, I want to talk about the Green Rebellion BP will be facing at its annual shareholder meeting on Thursday. So what's happening? Well, some of Britain's largest pension funds are preparing to ask the company to toughen its plans to reduce its emissions by 2030. The funds that are included are the National Employment Saving Trust, which represents about 11 million individual workplace pensions, the University Superannuation Scheme, and the Council Pensions Funds Border to Coast. In other words, not small players. So these funds have agreed to back a resolution put forward by the climate campaign Follow This, which is calling for BP to align its emissions reduction plans with the Paris Agreement. So all that is great. However, BP's board has urged shareholders to vote against the resolution, saying it would threaten BP's long-term value creation. But the three pension funds are also expected to vote against the re-election of BP's chairman, Helge Lund, in protest at BP's decision to water down its green pledges earlier this year without shareholder consent. So let's stay tuned. Hopefully the outcome of the annual shareholder meeting on Thursday will be positive and force BP to toughen its plans to reduce emissions, which would be a big win for shareholder activism. And now let's go back to the episode with Chloe.
To dive straight in, I'm very happy to welcome Delphine Willio, who is the Policy and Campaigns Manager at Fashion Revolution, the largest activism movement in the fashion industry. I think that's how you call it. Hi, Delphine. Thank you so much for being here today. How are you doing?
Good, Chloe. Thank you so much for having me.
We're super happy. Before we dive into the actual questions, we usually have one for all of our guests. It's what's your coffee order?
Non-existent, because I don't drink coffee.
Wow. Are you one of these tea people?
Yeah, I'm one of those people. The only time I've ever drank coffee was in Greece. They had like this frozen coffee, and it's probably the only time in my life I've ever enjoyed it. So yeah, this frozen coffee, if I have to, but in general, definitely not. More of a tea person.
Okay, interesting. Okay, let's dive straight in. So in the intro, we talked about the Rana Plaza, which was an absolute disaster. Do you know, can you explain what was the immediate response from brands and authorities following the Rana Plaza tragedy? Because obviously it shook a lot of people across the world. It was a big thing in the media. Everyone talked about it. What was the immediate response right after the disaster?
Well, I think from the brands, they probably had to, I think they probably had to wait a little bit to know if, or to find out if they were actually producing in that factory. I think that was the incident that really highlighted the lack of transparency within the fashion industry, because people had to literally look through the rubbles of the incident to find labels and see, you know, what brands were actually producing in that factory. And brands, you know, it could have been any brand, but brands themselves were unaware whether they were producing. So I think it must have been incredibly stressful for them to know or to wait until some of their labels might be fined, and then the press would get a hold of them, and they would obviously be named and shamed. So I think from a brand perspective, it really, it could have been any factory. I think it really does highlight the fact that the fashion industry doesn't have visibility, doesn't have traceability, and clearly lacks transparency on its overall supply chain. So again, the brands that we know today were part of the factory, it could have been any brand within the fashion industry, given the lack of transparency that we know the industry suffers from.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you're right. It completely highlights this issue of transparency, which is why Fashion Revolution sort of started in the first place. We'll hear from our second guest, Namza, what are the key points on the accord on fire and safety in Bangladesh that was implemented. So that's more like the policy response. And some people say that it was the most effective labor rights initiative ever carried out in contemporary apparel supply chain. What was Fashion Revolution thoughts on it? Was it enough when it was implemented, and were you happy with its impact?
I think it's definitely been an absolutely instrumental tool that came out of such a tragedy. I think, is it enough? No, I think there has been gaps in its implementation. I know there has also been criticism of the accord itself, but I think it was 2 years ago now, about 2 years ago now, we campaigned for its renewal. And we still found a lot of brands who said the accord has not done enough, or we don't want to support it again. We don't see the purpose of it. And we actively had to email those brands to ask them to support the accord, given that, of course, we don't think that it's enough, that we still need this type of enforcement today. But at the moment, it is the only tool where there is a tripartite system that does ensure greater safety for the workers in Bangladesh.
Yeah, and we'll dive into a little bit later what can be done from other parts of the world, because obviously there's a huge responsibility in Europe, for instance, when it comes to ensuring that workers that produce the stuff that we consume are actually protected, but also from an environmental perspective. But so what's the status of the accord today? Because when I was researching, I sort of saw that it ended in 2018, and then there was a renewal, and then there's sort of a memorandum of understanding. I think that's how you say it today. But it's not, I think it's not super clear. So maybe if you can explain what's the status of it today. And as you said, are people really more protected with what's happening right now than they were before?
If it was before the Rana Plaza collapse, yes. So the way it worked is that there was discussion about the renewal of the accord, I think about a year or two ago. And some brands decided to sign up to it again. Other brands didn't. And we still have, you can see, campaign actually led by Clean Clothes Campaign as well as Remake, trying to get some more brands to sign up to the accord. Even some that had previously signed up. So at the moment, the accord is still in force, but the only issue is that some brands that had previously signed up to the accord are no longer taking part. So again, this is a huge issue. And on the day of the remembrance of the Rana Plaza collapse at Fashion Revolution, we will definitely make sure not only to remember the victims of this tragedy, but also flag that we still have a long way to go, and that the brand who haven't signed the accord absolutely must to avoid any further incidents like that to happen ever again in the fashion industry.
And after Rana Plaza, obviously there was a big spotlight that was put on the fashion industry that wasn't necessarily there before. And so in the past few years, we've seen so much social and environmental, and if you'd see me right now, you'd see that I'm quoting commitments from brands, from recycled plastic to, you know, sustainable cotton, whatever that means, to improving workers' working conditions. But at the same time, there's been so many scandals, you know, that have revealed that recycling water bottles into fabrics wasn't necessarily the best solution, to Shein workers working 18 hours a day for very little pay. What's the evolution of the sector been for you? Is the fashion sector doing better than it was 10 years ago? And I'm guessing your answer is that it's going to be maybe yes, but we're still very far from what we need. But has there been a positive evolution, or is it all marketing and fake commitments?
I think we're definitely seeing an increase in greenwashing, given that now we're seeing a lot more brands using terminology such as carbon positive or planet positive and terminology like that. I think from an environmental perspective, given the increase of production levels in the fashion industry and the rise of ultra fast fashion, I just can't quite see how, from an environmental perspective, we've evolved. To be honest, I don't want to sound pessimistic, but I think from my side, the issue that we're facing in the fashion industry today is the fact that we're seeing such an increase in the amount of products that are churned and disposed of in the fashion industry that it's not only leading to an overproduction crisis, but also a waste crisis where clothes will be worn a handful of times and then disposed of and then be sent to countries that, you know, do not have the capacity to deal with the amount of waste that we're sending to them. And that will ultimately impact the local communities, their health, their ability to also just simply survive, given that that this will increase pollution. This will obviously have social ramifications as well. And I think from an environmental perspective, it's just very hard to see the step forward unless we start legislating on the amount of products that the industry produces. And especially given the rise of, supposedly tools to assess the sustainability of a type of material, I think we don't have enough data. That's another thing where I'm slightly hopeful that we are starting to see a bit more data coming directly from supply chains, but ultimately in the Fashion Transparency Index, for instance, which is our annual report that reviews and ranks 250 of the world's largest brands and retailers based on their public disclosure on human rights and environmental impacts. When we look at materials specifically, 45% of brands will claim to have a target on sustainable materials, but significantly less will actually disclose the methodology that they've used to assess what is considered a sustainable material. So you can kind of see that there's a huge gap between, you know, a brand will say, oh, we're using, 80% in 3 years, we'll have 80% of our sustainable, of our materials will be sustainable. But then how do you substantiate this claim? I think there's still a huge gap in knowledge. So that's from an environmental perspective. From a human rights perspective, I think one thing that we're also seeing is that ultimately a lot of these abuses, even linked to, for instance, the Rana Plaza collapse, is linked to wages and poverty wages ultimately. The reason why garment workers went to work in this factory wasn't because they wanted to. They knew beforehand that the factory itself was structurally unsound, but they still decided to go in and work there simply because they needed to earn their wages. And I think that's another issue where we're not seeing the progress that we need within the fashion industry today, where poverty wages are still prevalent, whether that's in Europe or whether, abroad. I think there's a huge misconception that if it's produced in Europe, it means that the people who made those clothes have been paid fairly. That's just simply not the case, which is why I'll do a quick plug-in for our Fashion Revolution campaign, but which is why we launched the Good Clothes Fair Pay campaign, which demands EU legislation on living wages for any brand who wants to sell their products in the EU market. So as part of this campaign, we need to get 1 million signatures from anyone with an EU passport. And this really would ensure that brands have to take action and close the gap between what garment workers in their supply chain are currently earning, which, as we know, is just not enough, and what they should be earning, which is a living wage.
Yeah, and you're completely right to plug that in, because actually we were going to link it. And the topic of the second episode that we're going to do at the end of Fashion Revolution Week is actually on what Europe should do. So I'm actually going to ask you in a second, what do you think Europe should do in terms of regulation? But you mentioned the transparency index, and that's another point that I wanted to ask you. Have you seen progress? Because I remember, fun fact for podcast listeners, I was actually a Fashion Revolution coordinator for Belgium years ago. And I remember there was years ago, there was always these numbers when the transparency index would come out that were quite low in terms of transparency. And the brands that were willing to actually share information was quite low. Has there been an improvement over the past few years? Are brands more willing to, you know, share information for you guys to dig in?
Absolutely. I think one thing that we've seen is the number. So when we started off the index, we didn't engage as many brands. We now engage over 250 brands to be exact. And I think what's been really interesting is across the board, we've seen an increase in terms of engagement from brands. And that means that more and more brands every year are participating. So we've seen from very few brands participating when we first started off to now 62% of brands that are featured within the Fashion Transparency Index are actually taking part. And I think the reason why we started the Fashion Transparency Index is first and foremost looking at transparency and traceability of supply chains. And just to give you a number, so when we first started off the index, very few brands were actually disclosing their suppliers list. So in 2017, for instance, out of the 100 brands that we were reviewing, only 32% of them disclosed or published their tier one suppliers list. Now, out of 250 brands, we have 48% of brands publishing their suppliers list. And I think another thing that's really key is that we were always told that the luxury sector would never, ever, ever publish their suppliers list for many, many reasons, including competition. And now we're starting to see luxury brands coming to us and actually publishing their suppliers list in the public domain. So I think that's the first. And I do think that it is linked to conversations that we've been having with brands behind the scene to push them to publish this in the public domain, basically. So in a way, that's really positive, but ultimately transparency leads to accountability, leads to change. But at the moment, we're still at 23% average score on our Fashion Transparency Index, which is incredibly low when you think about the brands that we review have entire sustainability teams dedicated to communicate on their sustainability initiatives, on their suppliers list, and so on. And given that these teams have huge budgets to do this, it's actually quite shocking that we're still the score is still so low. So we still have a very, very far, long way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so interesting because when you talk about these gigantic brands and their strategies and their misleading and the lack of transparency and also the lack of information when it comes to calculating and explaining the numbers, the parallels with the fossil fuel industry are just so, so big. And it actually leads me to my next question, just going back a little bit on the environmental impact. You know, lately studies have revealed how bad fashion, and especially the fast fashion industry, is for the planet, whether it's on climate, where the fashion industry is responsible for between 8 to 10% of global emissions, according to the UN, which is more than the aviation and shipping sector combined, or the fact that right now over two-thirds, 69% of textiles are made from plastic, which is expected to grow to 73% by 2030. How do you see the future of the fashion industry when it comes to the environmental impact? Because at the same time, there's increased discussion on sustainability, right? On climate, on materials, on circular economy as well. But then there's these numbers. So do you think the fashion industry is just completely unable on its own to actually make progress because they're in a system that makes them constantly produce more? Or do you think there's actually hope that they might improve their environmental impact?
I think from my side, there's two things. The first is, and I think I come from I've got an environmental auditing background. So I used to go to factories and review their energy consumption, water consumption, waste production, and so on. So we didn't have a single fashion client when I was working there. And then I moved to Fashion Revolution and I realized, hold on a minute, not a single factory has a environmental health and safety manager on site that collects that type of data. So, you know, when I hear numbers around the fashion industry contributes to a certain percentage of, you know, global greenhouse gas emissions, I'm always a little bit skeptical, because where is this data coming from? In that we don't actually know the environmental impacts at factory level, and it's only by collating all this data across the supply chain that you're then able to say, this is, you know, the water consumption in this country for all these factories and so on. We don't have that data. We know that it's not being collected currently. So I think that's the first issue when it comes down to environmental impact linked to the fashion industry, is that you can't fix what you can't see. And at the moment, there's just simply no data. Everything is based on estimates for specific regions, but obviously cotton production is going to be very different in a country like Brazil and in a country like Pakistan, for instance. You're going to have to take into account different variables. So that's the first thing. The second is there's no tracking at factory level. How are we then meant to assess, you know, like how to reduce water consumption if you don't even know in the first place how much water you're consuming? Same thing with waste. There's lots of countries that don't have waste mechanisms or in place, for instance. So I think that's the first thing that I'm really keen to see resolved within the fashion industry, is to make you know, this data collection compulsory, and then you can start addressing your environmental impact. The second is around overproduction. At the moment, there is not a single legislation that looks at fining or taxing brands that are producing so many clothes, and we're not seeing these brands slowing down anytime soon. I really think that, and this is something that Fashion Revolution would like to push at EU level at least, is legislation around how do you make sure that brands are held accountable regarding the amount of clothes that they're producing. Because obviously we can't say you can't produce over a certain amount, but we can definitely tax them based on the amounts that they're producing. So those are definitely two things that I want the fashion industry to look at in order to mitigate its environmental impacts.
Yeah, and actually, as a sort of sneak peek for our second episode, what are the three top policies that you think should be implemented, and actually before implemented, adopted, so negotiated, adopted and implemented in Europe that would have the biggest impact to actually improve the environmental and social impact that the fashion industry has? If you had to limit yourself to three, I know it's difficult, but what are your top three?
Definitely living wages, because there's also a link between living wages and overproduction, because if suppliers are pressured to produce more with less money and less time, that ultimately leads to overproduction and the inability to pay a living wage. And to a certain extent, we could hope that if we pay garment workers a living wage, that would also mean that brands who are taking on those additional costs would also potentially produce less. So that's one thing. Is for me, you can't have sustainable fashion without fair pay. So that's my priority, is making sure people who make our clothes are paid fairly. The second one is something around taxing overproduction and extended producer responsibility. So legislation around not only addressing the root cause, which is overproduction, but also what do you do with the amount of clothes that we're currently producing? So making sure that we have stringent extended producer responsibility legislation. And I think the third one, and something that we don't often hear about, is the level of inequality that we're seeing within the fashion industry. I would really like to see a pay ratio between, you know, the fashion CEOs and fashion executives, as well as employees and garment workers, because I think the level of inequality that we can see in the fashion industry is like no other industry. Some of the richest men in the world are actually all part of the fashion industry. So I think that's also something I really am keen to push for. We can't have brands claiming that they're not able to pay more for the clothes that they're making and the people who are making them, when ultimately, you know, the people who own those brands are some of the richest individuals in the world.
I have just two very, very quick questions. Last questions, I promise. The first one is, I'd love to get your thoughts on this whole, indeed, overproduction idea versus supporting the livelihoods of people that are producing, right? Because this is an argument that we hear a lot in the industries, that from an environmental perspective, we know we need to consume less. But at the same time, if we consume less, isn't that going to affect negatively the millions of people that depend on the fashion industry to earn a livelihood? So how do we sort of get out of this dilemma?
I think two things. The first one is, I also think the cost of clothes should be reflective of the cost of labor. And I think that's something where I think it's about buying less, buying better, and also making sure that, you know, the cost of clothes reflect that. So if that means increasing slightly your, you know, your bikini that you currently pay 90p for, I think that's something that's that should be done. The second is, I don't think this is enough of an argument to not shift the levels of production. When you think of other industries that have gone through similar changes, I'm thinking of the core industry in Europe, especially in the UK in the 80s. I think the way it was handled was shameful. But it doesn't mean that we should still rely on something that is inherently unsustainable. It's not because people are working in an industry that we, I think we need to ensure that there is finances to retrain the people out of the industry if we are going to significantly reduce the amount of products that we're making. But it doesn't mean that we should continue an industry that is inherently unsustainable just so that we can keep people employed in poverty wages for a few more years. You know, there is no fashion on a dead planet. Ultimately, there's no clothes on a dead planet, and most of the people who are making our clothes are also living in regions that are incredibly vulnerable to the climate crisis. So ultimately, it's about, you know, having a long term vision and seeing how we can support a transition as well out of the industry, if that means that, you know, we can't uphold the levels of productions that we're seeing today. I think the first one ultimately is about making sure that the people who make those clothes are paid fairly, first and foremost, and putting on the market products that reflect that. And secondly, I think it's also about definitely ensuring that we have the funds and that brands also put in place funds to support that transition, for sure. And I really do feel that they should be accountable for this.
Absolutely. And just my final question, as we're getting into Fashion Revolution, and hopefully this episode will be released on the first day of Fashion Revolution week, what can people do? So you've mentioned the Good Clothes Fair Pay ECI, so European Citizens Initiative, and we'll definitely link into the description. Is there something else that people can do?
Absolutely. I think depending on where you are, I think obviously connecting with your Fashion Revolution country team Instagram. If you're based in Belgium, we do have a Fashion Revolution team in Belgium, and I know that they will be hosting tons of events during Fashion Revolution week, so make sure that you attend those events. I think the second thing is don't see yourself as consumers, but also as citizens. I think we often forget, when it comes down to the fashion industry, that we can also call for the legislation we want to see and talk to our policymakers to discuss those legislation. So I think if you live in the EU, for instance, you can still email MEPs or tweet to them demanding specific legislation by supporting campaigns like Good Clothes Fair Pay or like Justice is Everybody's Business, which demands due diligence legislation for all industries, including the fashion industry. So I think there's many, many calls to action. Definitely read our Fashion Transparency Index, and at the very end you will see that we have created an entire section dedicated to all the calls to action that you can do using our data. We say don't use the Fashion Transparency Index to inform your purchases, but use it to inform your activism. So ask brands, who made my clothes, who made my fabrics, ask them difficult questions. We know that if a certain number of people ask these questions, they will be raised at executive level, and then brands tend to communicate on these issues as well publicly. So I think it's really key to not forget that we're not just consumers, but we're also citizens, and we can ask difficult questions to brands. We have email a brand toolkits that you can use on our Fashion Revolution website. So there's lots of resources that you can look at, whether it's on Fashion Revolution's website or on our country team's website, and on our Good Clothes Fair Pay website as well. So make sure that you have a look at all those resources.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Delphine, for taking the time in this crazy week as Fashion Revolution Week is getting ready to launch, to tell us a little bit about what the fashion industry looks like 10 years post Rana Plaza. And I wish you a lovely day.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Hi, it's Melissa again. Just quickly jumping in to let you know that the quality of the recording that you're about to hear isn't top notch. However, we hope that you'll be able to understand and hear the determination and passion that Nazma Akhter puts into all her work at the Awaj Foundation defending workers' rights.
And so to discuss this, I'm very happy today to welcome Nazma Akhtar, who is the Executive Director at Awash Foundation. Awash Foundation is a grassroots labor rights NGO with over 600,000 members in Bangladesh. They strive to amplify workers' voices for decent working conditions in the apparel supply chain. Nazma Akhtar started working in a garment factory at age 11. Thank you so much, Nazma, for agreeing to talk to us today. We have a first question that we ask all our guests. It's, what's your favorite hot drink? What do you usually, do you usually drink anything in the morning to sort of wake you up before you start your day?
Actually, mostly I like to drink water. And I'm trying to drink water every day. And then I like fruits, but I don't like much juices.
Interesting. Yeah. Good point. We explained in the introduction, you know, the Rana Plaza disaster, right? And how it definitely was the worst industrial disaster in Bangladesh and the worst apparel disaster in the world. I wanted to ask you, what was the immediate response, both from the brands and the authorities in Bangladesh, just right after the Rana Plaza tragedy, in the next few days and few months after it happened? What was the response?
The immediate action from our government to rescue the people and release from the rabble. That's the first things happened. And from the brand side, they didn't say anything and they didn't do anything when it's come to big campaign of the Rana Plaza murder, killing, and the building collapse. It was very difficult to face the brand side, manage those situation and kind of things.
And was there any, were people put on trial in Bangladesh after the Rana Plaza? Was there, you know, accountability and responsibility for, you know, the factory managers, for instance?
It's very sad that all the factory owner, they got bail and they are not in the prison. So no one is any penalty or any action against them.
Wow, and that is 10 years later.
Yeah, it's 10 years later. It's no justice. It's brother and sister who lost their life, who severely injured and lifelong pain and suffer. Their family are hunger and they didn't get the justice. So we want justice. And even the there was a 32 brand was producing that factory. So even they didn't get anything from their country also.
Yeah, absolutely. So what, yeah, that's actually a really good follow-up question is, what came out of the brands that were involved in the, that were producing in the Rana Plaza factory? Did the victims ever get any financial compensation from these brands?
Actually, you know, the victim, the workers, they got some money. It's a Rana Plaza trust fund. And it's not only the which company and the brand and retailer or multinational producing, they gave the compensation. It's not like that. Many of the brand who are working in that company, on those factory, and who are not all brand, they are giving little contribution and it's creating a trust fund. But the workers should not get the trust fund or charity because it's something like volunteer initiative or kind of things, but worker didn't get their fair compensation and fair rights, which is very painful and which is we still demand the worker should get and earn the compensation, loss of earning and loss of income, because one worker supposed to work 60 years, but maybe some workers, their age might be 20, 25, 30, but rest of the 30 years they can work. So we won our loss of earning and our respect and dignity.
So in May 2013, so a few days after the Rana Plaza disaster, the Accord on Fire and Building Safety in Bangladesh was signed by 220 companies. And the Accord called for immediate action, an implementation plan that required safety inspection, safety training, and remediation of dangerous conditions in garment factories. Was it enough? Was this accord enough? And did it create long-lasting change in legislation? Did it actually improve the conditions?
Yes, it is one of the historical initiative, which is legal binding initiative by the international brand and the global union, and it saves millions of workers' life today. And also the accord is doing fire safety, building safety, and electrical safety. And also the now accord is expanded beyond in Pakistan International Accord.
Since the Rana Plaza disaster, there were at least 109 more accidents that have taken place, according to the International Labour Organization, like factory fires and building collapses. That still seems to be the reality for people working in clothing factories in low-income countries. So, I mean, you said that the Accord was a great step. Why are there still so many accidents? Like, what is still needed so that these accidents don't take place anymore and people are actually protected?
Like Accord is mostly signing the European brand. And it, for example, Bangladesh has over 4 million workers. Accord, under the Accord factory is 2 million plus. So we need to sign all brand, and especially the American brand retailer. They don't believe, they don't respect the union rights. Then they don't sign the union. Very few companies are signing the accord. And rest of the, like Walmart, Gap, JCPenney, Levi's, those are the big, big company, the jeans producing and other production they made in my country, also in Pakistan and rest of the world. They need to also sign, and they need to respect the union rights. They need to respect the decent working condition.
Mm. So according to you, the solution to even lower more the number of accidents is for more brands to sign the accords, right?
Yeah, and more factory has to be unionized, more workers' freedom of expression, freedom of association, workers' voice, negotiation power. It's important because if they have this kind of power, they can raise their voice and they can resolve those issues.
Maybe this is a good moment to ask you, is this what you're doing with the Awash Foundation, and what are you trying to push for in the sector with the work that you're doing?
We are educated, our brother and sister, the workers. We are educated, the factory level management. We are doing lobby advocacy. We are providing legal aid support, and we are also trying to help to organize the union and the female leadership and empowering them, and through negotiation and collective bargaining is our main job. So our organization, we work for the freedom of association, collective bargaining, living with gender-based violence, social protection, and climate change.
So recently, recently 3 years ago already, we had the COVID-19 pandemic. And that really like solidified many of the issues that are faced in the fashion industry. And in many ways, it sort of slowed down the progress that were being made. So in March 2020, it was reported that several large fashion brands were refusing to pay for fulfilled orders. And so the Pay Up campaign was launched to demand corporate accountability for the estimated $40 billion worth of inventory ordered, fulfilled, but not paid for. What did you think about that? What was the feeling of the workers in Bangladesh seeing all the work that was put in and the fact that the brands didn't want to pay for this?
You know, that COVID 2020, the brand holding suspension, holding cancellation for the order, and also asking for a discount, and our workers also pay the salary of 2020, the discount. We found that they are not even pay the bill on time, and also so-called bankruptcy, and then they didn't get the money, and all the waste thief. So therefore, we started campaign on the Pay Up. We are successful.
How do you see the future? Because there's obviously a huge conversation, including in Europe, about reducing the consumption of textiles from an environmental point of view, right? And addressing the fast fashion industry and the impact that the fast fashion industry has on the planet. But that would also mean impact to a big industry that is supporting the livelihood of millions of people. So how do you see that sort of like, is this even a dilemma? What's the solution to you? If we reduce the amount of garments that we consume, would this affect the livelihood of people?
Actually, we want the business, we want to continue this job because, you know, in the poor and rural people doesn't have the job opportunity available in Bangladesh, especially the women. So therefore, we want the job, we want the job, and therefore we need how to get the workers better wages. We want, and it's needed for the mandatory human rights due diligence initiative need to be taken, and it should be taken by all the government. And because, you know, the Rana Plaza 10 years, it's not only the Rana Plaza, there is a Taj Green Fire, there is a Ali Enterprise in Pakistan. So therefore, I said all the country, they are taking profit, they are taking all the margin, and our workers always getting charity and volunteer initiative, which is never sustained and it's never worked. So therefore, we need like Rana Plaza factory owner, many factory has been collapsed, a fire, and also some factories collapsed, but there is no justice our workers get. Yes, that's why we need the legal initiative and legal action. So European Union country, different country in Europe and America, Australia, other country, they have to do the legal binding mandatory due diligence and how to get the punishment, the brand, yes. If any company has any issues, and if some company are violating their workers' rights or violating any issue, then country like Bangladesh, myself or the worker can go to your court, raise our issue in the court.
I think that's all the questions I had. Nazma, thank you so much for answering to us, and thank you so much for the amazing work that you're doing in Bangladesh. It was really, really lovely to hear about the incredible fights that you're putting up, and we should all be inspired by the work that you're doing for sure.
Thank you very much. And who will are listening to me, I request all the consumer and all the people, please respect the workers. We are requesting no gender-based violence, no harassment, no abuse. We want harassment, abuse-free, women's friendly workplace. We want freedom of association and collective bargaining, women's workers' voice and women's negotiation, and pay fair and pay decent and respect.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Burning Case podcast. We hope you liked it. If you want to support the podcast, click follow on Spotify or Apple Music. It helps others find us. Also, if you think other people might find our content interesting, don't hesitate to share it on your social media or in the old-fashioned way by talking about us to your friends and community. We hope you'll be back for the next episode. Have a great day.